Hey, this is Michael Hutchinson, and you're listening to the Front Row Podcast.
I'm here with Andy Van Hammond, who's a former ref who played refed 1,475 NHL games. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As I know you got coached by Bob Kristol back in your younger days. How was that?
Was a terrific man. He helped us at Isaac Brock Community Center and coached us, and had played professional hockey himself, so he knew all the ins and outs on how to get the puck out of the end and into the end, and we learned a lot from him. It was a pretty exciting time for all of us.
And how did you transition from hockey into reffing?
Well, I played junior hockey for the Winnipeg Braves, and I played juvenile hockey at Orioles Community Club and also at Isaac Brock. And I decided that I had no future playing professional hockey, and so I had always refereed kids hockey on Saturday morning at the local community center, and I liked it, and they were looking for referees to get involved, so a fellow named Gord Kerr, who was the referee-in-chief and did a lot of junior hockey games when I had played, said that, you know, if you're interested, we use the two-man referee system, so you'll get a chance to referee right away. So I had always been fairly interested and helped out at the community club on Saturday mornings doing the Playground A, Playground B, Playground C when I was a little older, 16, 17, I did the 10-year-olds, so I liked it, and that's how I got started. So I pursued it, and with expansion in the NHL taking place, they needed more officials, just like they needed more players. And I always look back at it. I was sort of in the right spot at the right time, and I got started young at 21, 22 years old. I was able to make it. And then the World Hockey was starting, so they needed officials, so there was a real kind of demand for people, and I was one of the younger ones that could get into it. So that's how I got started.
Yeah, it's like back then they had two different leagues, the NHL and the WHL, back in the 70s. So they needed more refs, right?
Correct. Yep, that was correct. But we only had one ref and two linesmen, and I really didn't want to be a linesman. I'd like to, you know, sort of not run the game, but be involved with it a little in more depth than being a linesman has the job of offsides and icings, where the referee has to make more judgment.
Yeah, it's like, and plus the equipment's different from back then until now, and like, you're one of the first referees to wear a helmet?
Yes, I feel very proud about that, because now a lot of them are wearing not only a helmet but face shields, and I took a lot of ribbing at the time. I was at a referee school in New Brunswick, St. Andrews, and one of the young kids asked why we, at the NHL level, do not wear helmets, where they, at the minor league level, had to wear helmets. So I said, it's a good question. You're right. The NHL players shoot the puck faster, and they shoot it harder, and you guys are wearing it probably to protect yourself in case you would fall, but I think we should wear it because of the speed of the puck that gets shot around the glass and off the board. So I went to camp that year, and I asked the guys, I said, you know, why are we ever going to consider wearing a helmet? And they sort of snickered, and some of them laughed. They said, well, why don't you wear one? And I said, you know what, I got a couple of kids at home. I wouldn't want to bang my head off the ice and not be able to look after them as they grow up. And so I went to the league and I asked what our insurance was if I ever did get hurt, and seriously enough that I couldn't maybe, you know, have to sit in a wheelchair or hurt my head or whatever. And they said, you get $50,000 one-time payout. So I thought, that's not going to bring my family up if I ever became disabled. So I put a helmet on, not only for protection, but for the reason that we had to set a better example for the younger kids that were refereeing, that, you know, we should do it too. So eventually it's come around now where they all wear it, and some of them even have visors on, which obviously is very important to protect one's eyesight. So I feel real good about starting that out way back when, 1986, I got it started.
Yeah, your first NHL game was November 22nd of 1972. Were you nervous about reffing your first game?
Yeah, it was in Chicago. Vancouver was playing, and it was quite an exciting time. You know, like, you're nervous. You've heard about the Chicago Stadium, but you've never been in it. And when the Oregon started to play, and, you know, Orland Curtinback was the captain of Vancouver, and Chicago had Pat Stapleton and Pierre Palat. It was people that I had grown up watching, and now I was actually on the ice with them refereeing, and then I was probably 23, 24 years old, so it was quite exciting, and it was quite... It was hard to believe at first.
Yeah, so you got to see the good players from your younger days, and you saw players coming up who are superstars later, right? So you kind of got to see both, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I got started young enough, and I was in a whole bunch of different eras. The era of the Islanders winning the cups, and then the era of Edmonton winning a bunch of cups, and Pittsburgh winning cups with Lemieux and Mario Lemieux, and the Islanders had Bossy, Trotche. You know, it was a real good time to be around that the game, because it was expanding, and there was always new players coming along that, just like now, though. I mean, a couple of young players from Montreal that are playing so well, Caulfield and Suzuki.
Yeah,
I mean, they've just made that team a lot more explosive, and you know, they skate so well and they handle the puck so well. And that was the same back then. Every year there was somebody new coming into the league that, you know, sort of just blossomed into a top player. Like, I mean, people talk about somebody like Gary Lehman. You know, he wasn't anything fantastic, but he scored, you know. And Rick Vive, they scored like 50 goals or got a lot of goals in a time when you wouldn't think that would be happening, you know?
Yeah, you got to see like someone like Wayne Gretzky coming into the league and tearing it up like through the in the 80s, 90s.
The team they put around them, you know, with Messier and Yuri Curry and...
Yeah.
Paul Coffey could skate as fast with the puck as most people skate without it. You know, him and Bobby Orr were the probably the two quickest guys, defensemen that would ever play the game, and they could skate so quick with the puck that they caused so much more ice and position for forwards to get it open to get good shots on the goal because of their speed. So it's fun being down on the ice and seeing this happen like 10 feet, 20 feet in front of you.
Especially Timo Solani here in 92, 93 when he broke Mike Bossy's record.
Yep, a terrific player, a nice man.
Yeah.
Played the game the way it should be played. You know, he worked hard at it and seemed to be well-liked and... turned out to be a terrific player.
Yeah. What's your best memory from reffing?
Probably doing, there's probably two things. Doing the seventh game between Philadelphia and Edmonton for the Stanley Cup one year. Easter. The Islander-Washington game that took three, we were in the seventh game. It took three periods, and it was tied, and then we played three more periods of overtime, and it was still tied, and then we went into the fourth period of overtime, and Pat LaFontaine scored in Game 7 to knock the Washington out, and then the Islanders went on to play against Pittsburgh, I think, in the next round. So being on the ice that long, we started at 7:30, and I got off the ice around 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was quite different to do two games in one night, you know. So that's one I remember the most.
Yeah, that's, I have, like, former players like Daryl Stanley, who played in the 80s with Philly and Vancouver. He came on and told me stories and how he went to the final with them in 87, I think, against Edmonton. And he said, yes.
Yeah, he was with Flyers, I think.
Yeah.
That's what it would have been, yeah.
Yeah. He's a good friend of mine, and Bob Crystal's a good friend of mine.
Oh, wow, good.
Yeah, and then, yeah, they told me different stories from what they, how they played and how they, certain players played and that, and they, how it's different from their day to now, and they.
Well, nothing stays the same. Everything, and I don't know whether it's for the good or the worst of things, but, you know, we've advanced, everything moves. They train differently. It's a year-round job now, where before it was mostly, you know, they would get ready at training camp and start playing. Now the young players now are training, you know, 12 months of the year to get that much better and that much advanced in their skating and in their stick handling. So it was a good time, meaning that the game was good. There was a lot of things happening, and it was advancing, and there was a lot of jobs being created, and it really made you aware of the fellows that put their time in, like Bob and, you know, even Don Cherry and different players that had to play in the minor leagues for so many years because there was only six NHL teams.
Yeah.
And they were like the cornerstone. They made the game what it is today. You know, the young players now come in and there's so many more openings, so many more positions, so many more teams.
Yeah, like Seattle coming in for next season, and that's adding more slots for players to come into the league.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's like a company. It's like a company expanding, right?
Yeah.
You know, you split it out with six teams, and they were there forever, and then it went to 12, and then it added two more, then it went to 14, and now we're at going to be at 32. I mean, it's a terrific, terrific growth, and I just hope that the players that are there today have some memory of who created all this, and that's the players that are back from the 50s and 60s, and you know, when they didn't get paid a lot of money, but they loved playing the game.
Yeah, so yeah, like same thing with the AHL, they're expanding, and that's good for the sport and bringing in money. And
well, yeah, and they need the development. I mean, players' careers are shorter, but there's a lot of interest, and cities are, you know, getting a pro team by having an American League team. And somebody like Winnipeg, it's really important that they have their farm system so close by that they can draw a player up and they watch them play and see who's developing and who needs to improve on what area of the game. And so those things didn't happen before. You used to have to travel a long way to get to the NHL team.
Yeah, kind of like when the Jets first came back, and they had the farm team in St. John's, and that's like a long way away to get them here. And now the team, they haven't bring the team back, and it's like they don't have to fly anywhere. They just can drive to the arena if they're in the same city, or just need to be a short flight somewhere, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, if, you know, if you had an emergency, somebody got sick, or they had to call somebody up, you know, it's really a benefit to have it ready in your own backyard, have somebody there sitting there waiting to play and fill the spot. So it's changed. A lot of the people, you know, in their 70s and 80s remember way back when, but the 20 and 25-year-olds don't, you know. So I hope that history gets sort of written about or displayed or constantly reminding the people that, you know, we've come from somewhere that was a job but not really a high paying job to something that's really special. Like, I mean, when you hear the salaries and the money these guys are making to play a game, I know they love playing it, but the old timers, you know, they love playing it too, and they didn't reap the same reward. So maybe I'm living in the past too, but I really think that there should be more recognition of people that started this game the way and got it to where it is today.
Yeah, like someone like Bob, and like got to help get it going and everything.
and stayed interested in it, and you know, worked with the Hall of Fame and different, you know, memberships of the old timers and all that stuff. It's really important to keep that bond going. So
you got inducted to the Hall of Fame in 99, the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Yes.
What's your thoughts on that when you first got told about it?
I was quite excited. It's not something that you ever think is going to happen. Not that you look, you know, you don't think when you're working and doing 20 Stanley Cup finals that, you know, this will be the sort of the end result or the icing on the cake. But I went in 1999 with Wayne Gretzky and my boss, Scotty Morrison, the man that hired me. So it was kind of a special time. And our family, my wife Cheryl and our three kids, were able to attend and be there for the ceremony, and got to see a lot of people that they had heard about, and now they got actually to meet them. And so I guess that should be one of my highlights, not doing a seven-period hockey game. I think of it, but it's something that's just nice to be recognized and nice to be thought of, that you have done something special and you belong in a Hall of Fame, which I'm quite honored to be in.
Yes, my uncle, he gave me a shirt from you signed, and he gave me your little pamphlet with your bio on that, and you signed it to me and stuff.
That's a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
And you still got it? You got it hanging on the wall, or you got it tucked away in a drawer?
I have it in the bag, tucked it nice and neat.
Okay. And do you ever wear it to any games? People might throw things at you.
No, I keep it nice and neat.
Okay. Well, I'm happy that I was able to do that for you, and it's great that you still have it. And you probably I've got two sweaters left. We used to get one sweater a year, so I had 25 years worth of sweaters.
Yeah.
And you know, people ask for donations. I remember the Lloydminster arena collapsed, the roof caved in, and they were fundraising. So you know, they asked you for something. So I gave them my sweater from the Stanley Cup playoffs that year, and thinking that, you know, it'll help. Every little bit helps. And they end up getting like $650 for my sweater, which I was just astounded by, you know, to think that somebody would wish to pay that much for a game used jersey. So anyway, I sit now, and we have three daughters. We don't have any, but I have son-in-laws, and so they look for stuff, and our grandkids look for stuff. So I wish I had to save some of the stuff, to tell you the truth.
Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me. And as I told you, we're just driving from Guelph, Ontario, to Ottawa to visit our oldest daughter and her family. Their son, our grandson, he plays hockey on a scholarship in the United States. So he's heading back next week. So we're going to have a visit with him this weekend. So that's why when I said to you I'll be in the car, that's what I meant. We're driving. I just stopped here in Kingston, halfway or partway there.
Okay.
So nice talking with you, Donald, and thanks for having me, and take care of yourself.
Okay. Drive safely.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye. And welcome back to the Front Row Podcast, Jamie.
Hey, buddy. Thanks for having me.
So, the expansion draft is in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I know. It's coming up on us. It's so weird that we have a Stanley Cup final coming in July, and the latest it could be is July 11th, and you think you have this little bit of a lull. It's been quiet overall, but in that middle part of July, it's going to get crazy for a bit, and then we're going to have 1 month off before, I don't know. I think the season starts mid-October, so I'm thinking mid-September for training camp. It's going to get by. It's going to be hockey real fast here for all of us.
Yeah, I think they have to hand in their paper by the 17th, and And then the draft is on the 21st.
Yeah.
So I don't...
Pretty crazy.
I don't envy Chevy right now.
No, I think, you know, you look at the guys that he has to choose from, and it seems to me your forwards are set. Just like, yeah, I don't know, maybe you're worried about losing Mason Appleton. Then your blue line is a tough choice there. You're not going to, clearly, Pionk and Morrissey are your two defensemen, and then you have a tough choice between Dylan DeMel and Logan Stanley. So, I mean, where do you go? What do you do? The thing is, Donald, we all think, because we're not in the war room with Chevy and the rest of the manager or the management team and the scouts and everybody, it's just there's more deals going on than we know about. I don't know if Ron Francis is going to be able to pull the wool over the eyes of a lot of teams the way, you know, the Vegas Golden Knights did, because that's not going to happen again, because you're going to have a lot of teams that are gun shy right now. But I still think there's going to be some wheeling and dealing done. It is really a tough idea to think of losing either DeMello or Logan Stanley to me. That's Logan Stanley's development happened at a great time, but not a great time in some ways, because now you're looking at this guy and you look at this guy and you're like, do we really want to lose him now? And Dylan DeMello was like rounding into form. Like, he was playing, him and Josh Morrissey looked tremendous in that series against Edmonton. So do you really want to be losing that? But losing Logan Stanley's size on a back end that's not exactly blessed with a lot of size and truculence. I mean, you're not a copycat league. They say what it is in the NHL and any pro sports league is copycat league. And you look at Montreal and look at the size of defensemen they have back there. And you look what the Jets had on their blue line in 2018 and 2019. Like, it's, you like to have some size and some meanness back there. So I don't know. It's, you're, as you said earlier, before I started rambling on, you do not want to be Kevin Cheveldayoff right now unless you have some wise choice or some wise deal that we don't know about with the Seattle Kraken.
So, yeah, you go 6-4 or 7-3. That's the tough part, right?
Yeah. And I still think you go 7-3 because, I mean, there's a wealth of your team is blessed with forwards. Like, it's just you can trade for a defenseman or sign a defenseman, hopefully, but I don't think you want to lose any of those forwards that are on the protected list right now. So, I mean, how, the thought of losing Mason Appleton is also frustrating, because to me, here's a guy who can play in your top six now. Like, he had a great year last year, and really drove, like, that's, you know, Paul Maurice mentioned this numerous times, there's that there's video being shown consistently of how you drive to the net. And Mason Appleton was the guy that was starring in those videos all year long for the Winnipeg Jets. So you really want to lose him, because he played in the top six in that last game against the Montreal Canadiens in game four and did not look out of place. He's ready, right? Like, there's a guy there, another guy that's developed just quickly, and or not quickly, but his development has got to a point where, like, you're sweating, you're waking up in the middle of the night sweating, losing the thought of losing him. So, this is the Winnipeg Jets are not the only team that are sitting here right now going, ah, crap, the expansion draft's coming around the corner. Nobody's celebrating that there's a 32nd team coming in outside of Seattle in the National Hockey League. And sure, maybe the owners, because you're getting a little extra cash when, man, cash is really, really something you can need after having a full year without any fans in the building. So it is a unique time. Hopefully this is the last expansion team we're going to have to deal with here for a long time, because the Jets have done great job of drafting, developing, and why should other teams get the fruits of their labor, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah, then you got your lots of UFAs and RFAs out there, right?
You got
Poolman, who's on UFA.
Yes.
So you can lose him to free agency. He's like, I wonder if he has, like, a side deal with certain players. Like, hey, I give you a raise if you don't sign with a different team, so we don't have to give you.
I know, like, all those decisions, right, Donald, that have to be made. Like, there's going to be a lot of reaction, knee-jerk reaction stuff after the expansion draft. But I agree with you. Like, Tucker Poolman is, you know, love him or hate him, in which you shouldn't hate him at all. He's a great skater. He does take chances in his right-handed shot. So it's just like the thought of him floating around out there. And I think you can keep him for a relatively modest price of just over $1 million a season. So, to me, that is some guy I think you can sign and keep in the lineup. But, you know, Derek Forbert was tremendous in terms of blocking shots and formed a great pairing with Neil Pionk. But lacks the foot speed, I think, that's necessary to keep up over an 82-game schedule and stuff like that. But I will never knock what Derek Forbert provided for the Winnipeg Jets through this season, because he logged a lot of miles, a lot of minutes, blocked a lot of shots. There's a lot of tread off those tires that he did, sacrificed his body a lot. And you still have Nathan Beaulieu kicking around too, right? I know he's not unrestricted or anything like that, but just tough decisions have to be made there too. So the back end is just start of it, and then you have to figure out what you're going to do with Andrew Kopp. Like, there's going to be a serious raise being considered there after a guy that scored, you know, career high in points. And because of injuries and because things worked out, man, like, he was on, his resume is loaded this year because of last season. Like, killing penalties, power play time, top line, you know, top 6 minutes. Like, there's all kinds of things that are working in Andrew Kopp's favor in terms of getting a good contract this year. And it's, you know, he's already been through arbitration once. Do you really want to go back there again? Because that is not fun for anybody. You already have some hurt feelings for the first time that they went through arbitration. So, Matthew Perreault, like, I thought, you know, a lot of people thought he was done when they put him on waivers, but the Jets knew that nobody was going to pick up his $4.5 million salary. So I don't really think that was the Jets writing him off. That was just like, okay, we're going to put him here because of salary cap reasons. I dare you to take him off or like pick him up right now, but with a flat cap. So I that was a genius move by the Winnipeg Jets. And he had a great year, but it was a contract year. So how much do you take into consideration what Matthew Perreault did last year and look for going forward?
I don't mind like Perreault, but not at $4.5 million. Like,
no, yeah, that's not going to happen at all, right? No. There's going to be some like your fourth line this year. And I know Matthew Perreault didn't stand there the whole time. The Dirty 30s, as Kelly Moore called them numerous times, was like, that's what you want. And you got a guy that's great in faceoffs, Nate Thompson. You got a Trevor Lewis, good speed. Like, those are your fourth line guys. You're not going to bring Christian Vesalainen into the fold just so he can play fourth line minutes. That's not how things work. And then you want another veteran guy on the left side, and that's what Matthew Perreault provided. And I would like to see Nate Thompson and Trevor Lewis come back next year and then fit in Vesalainen and Jansen Harkins. Like, Jansen Harkins did not have, you know, he was great the year before, just had a tough time this year really getting going. I know that's a lot to do with playing time and opportunities. But to me, you want those, you know, Paul Maurice says to him, that was the best fourth line he's had since 17-18. That was Matthew Perreault, Yoel Armia, and Matt Hendricks. So those are your penalty killing guys. And we've seen how good of a penalty killer Yoel Armia is right now with the Montreal Canadiens. So those, to me, Trevor Lewis and Nate Thompson, that's guys that you're going to be able to bring back on the cheap, because there's going to be some serious, Neil Pionk's going to get a raise this year. Andrew Kopp, if he's coming back, is going to be a raise this year. So I know you have cap space. You're going to have to try and go to get a right-handed shot some way, somehow, either trade for or sign through free agency. So it looks to me, and that, oh, you know what? What about David Gustafson? Like, I mean, that guy has been, you know, Paul Maurice said that a couple of years ago. This is a guy we're you know, grooming to be our fourth line center. Had a great year with the Moose. So, but do you want him and Vesalainen and sit on your fourth line, or Harkins? No, you don't. So I there's some tough decisions to make, but I think another year, especially with the quality of the division, the Jets will be back in next year. We all saw what the Central Division was, even though it was scattered all across the National Hockey League last year. It's going to be tough, and you're going to need those veteran players on the cheap, especially with the quantity of raises and getting that right-handed shot to help improve your blue line.
If you get Lewis, Perreault, and Thompson in total,
probably $1 million each.
Like, $1 million each, $3 million.
That'd
be great for the first line, but you don't probably won't get that, right?
No. I still think Matthew Perreault has earned himself a decent paycheck, just whether or not it's here. It's not going to be $4.5 million. We all know that.
Yeah.
I don't even know it's going to be $2.5 million. That's the tough part. So if he can get that, I don't know if it's going to be in Winnipeg.
Yes, yeah. Like, he's good, but not, like, I like him. He's, like, if you're going to use him as a fourth line, $4.5 million is too much. So, and then Stastny, if you're going to try and bring him back, and
Yeah, bubble, massive discount, right? That's the tough part is, where do you really want, like, okay, so Pierre-Luc Dubois is going to be your second line center at some point here, but do you continue to want him to learn from someone like Paul Stastny, which I think you still need to have? And Paul Stastny is not going to be at 6.5 either. There's going to be a serious negotiation going on there for how much you're going to do with that. So I still think Pierre-Luc Dubois needs that veteran voice in his ear guiding him, because he just needs to be like a pat on the back all the time. You're doing great. Just reminding him, because this seems like his confidence was up and down last year. And that is totally to be under, like, all the flack that Pierre-Luc Dubois took last year was completely unnecessary, because a guy comes in, misses 2 weeks because of COVID restrictions, had been going through a nightmare down in Columbus as a young kid. And you come here and it's a room full of veteran guys. You don't want to step on anybody's toes, but you do have that skill set to be able to play in the top six. And you don't want to step on his toes. Instead of shooting the puck, you're passing the puck to Blake Wheeler or giving it to Mark Scheifele or, you know, whoever he's playing with, Nikolaj Ehlers. Shoot the puck. Nikolaj Ehlers figured that out last year, and look what happened. If Pierre-Luc Dubois figures that out, then look out. For all the heat he took, it was ridiculous because no one took into consideration what he went through last year and being a young guy coming back to another dressing room. And the fact that you want to, like, I love Patrick Laine. I love him. He was great for the league. He was great for Winnipeg. Great for the media perspective, scored a lot of goals, but you're not going to find centermen are not laying around everywhere at that price and be able to have that type of team control. So good on Kevin Cheveldayoff for making that trade. And I think a full year next year, Pierre-Luc Dubois will be fantastic. But I still think Paul Stastny or somebody's going to have to, like, or Mark Scheifele is going to have to start. Do what Mark Scheifele did with Logan Stanley in the offseason, spend time with them, talk about the, you know, the diet, how hard you have to work and everything and work with them and that stuff. Scheifele does that with Dubois or somebody else. I think look out next year in 2021, 2022.
I know a defenseman I like is Pionk. He's pretty good back there. And
Yeah. Like, that is not going to be a cheap contract. But that all being said, guy can play power play, kills penalties, plays all over the place. Physical, lead your team in hits for a big point of the season. Like, there, it is not going to be cheap, Donald. Like, that is, I don't know what's going to be, but it's not going to be cheap. But you're not, to have him and Morrissey lined up there is a good place to be if you're the Winnipeg Jets. So I realize Morrissey's left-hand side, Pionk's the right-hand side, but whatever. That's another, more money that has to be put out, that's cutting into the pie a little bit, but it's going to be money well spent. Neil Pionk plays hurt. Like, he does not give up whatsoever. I saw him got bowled over. Draisaitl absolutely blasted him in that first round series. Didn't matter. Keeps getting up. That's what you want. And he's a great guy in the room and fantastic player. So clearly going to be back, but just at a much more expensive price.
And another person that Jets are going to miss the most is Pascal Finsen.
Yeah. From a development standpoint, there is a reason why these guys that were drafted and then played down, like Eric Dubois, yes. You cannot give enough credit to Eric Dubois for the work that he did with Logan Stanley or Tucker Poolman. I can go down the list. Nelson Noje, whenever he comes up, ready to go. Like, the whole Moose system works out to perfection. And I know we say it all the time, Donald, and Paul Murray says it all the time, but it's true. You're taking a guy that was drafted the fifth round, like Mason Appleton, you're helping him develop, blah, blah, blah. Comes to the NHL, succeeds. Logan Stanley is the best example. Oh, he's a bust. Why did they draft this guy? Well, because you had two first-round picks that year, you can take a chance on a guy that could be a first-round talent. And I know it's early, but here Pascal Vincent played a big role in that. And the fact that they got to play this year in the American Hockey League because of all the wizardry that had to be done with the doctors and everything and the trainers and everybody out there to make sure these guys played safe and got to play 36 games – has to be applauded. But Pascal Vincent, hands down, I'm surprised he's still was with the Moose. I thought he's obviously deserved an opportunity to be in the National Hockey League. And congratulations to him. Columbus has got a hell of a coach coming there. It's a tough loss for the organization, for the Winnipeg Jets, because this guy, it just seems like him and Paul Maurice were on the same wavelength all the time. Just whatever you ask him question about, it almost felt like you're talking to the same person. Pascal used a lot more words, which is hard to believe. but talks a little bit more than Paul Maurice does. But both, like, the organization could not ask for a better coach developing their players in the American Hockey League than Pascal Vincent. So that's a huge loss for them, but a tremendous opportunity for Pascal Vincent, and well-deserved. And congratulations to him, because he earned it.
Yeah, he did well in the queue when he was there, too, when he was coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and he did a great job. He coached with Winnipeg for a stint, too, right? Yeah. Before he got handed the reins to the Manitoba Moose. Always took part of training camp to start the year for the Jets. Was up there until they start forming the Manitoba Moose roster. But it is going to be really strange when the Moose start next year, and it's not going to be Pascal Vincent behind the bench.
Yes, I wonder who they're going to bring in for the Moose, or get someone else up, like one of the assistants up, or
yeah, does Dubois get an opportunity? Does Mark Johnson get a chance? Right, that's where you have to wonder how that's going to fit out. But you do need another coach on the staff. Yeah. At some point. So how is it a promotion, or is it somebody in from the outside? We're gonna have to wait and see.
So Patrick Maroon, he's in his third straight Stanley Cup final, could win his third straight. So that's
remember when Patrick Laine called him fat?
It's like I think not recently that no player won three straight cups. Since the Islanders back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Wait.
There was no more annoying team than New York Islanders, Donald. Well, when I was a kid, I was a Flyers fan and growing up, and they annoyed the hell out of me. So that was a great dynasty. I love how, I don't know if you saw Stan Fischler saying the Edmonton Oilers dynasty, that was a long time ago. I just saw a clip recently on YouTube. I thought it was, you know, how clips kind of find their way back through the mill again or whatever. Stan Fischer saying the Oilers were a dynasty. The Oilers were a dynasty. But, man, the Islanders were unreal. But so you can see why it's been so long since a team. And Mariehosa was in a bunch of Stanley Cup finals. He just didn't win them. So that was the big difference. Well, he missed out a couple of times before finally winning a bunch. Like, Pat Maroon is the perfect playoff player. Like, that's a guy you want. He'll block shots. He's heavy on the puck. Can play that playoff style game, so he's a great addition, and congratulations to him because he's a good dude.
He won with St. Louis in 19, last year with Tampa Bay, and he's there again. Then Hossa, he was there with Pittsburgh, lost. Then he went over to Detroit, then lost
to Pittsburgh.
And then he won with Chicago in the following year in 2010.
Yeah. So it's like three straight appearances, but two losses, and finally third time's the charm. So, Mariehosa is a fascinating study in terms of like leaving and signing someplace and then ending up in the Stanley Cup final. But good for Pat Maroon.
So I have a whole set Sens jersey, so I'm like kind of happy for him winning. Same thing with like
good player, great player, great player.
That's like. I'm happy for him. Same thing with Slaney. Happy when he got the cup in 07.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of good players like Ray Bourque. Like, you go down the list.
Yeah, Ray Bourque. He was spent the whole time in Boston and got traded to Chicago.
Ran into the Edmonton Oilers a couple of times and a lot of other teams.
Yeah, and then he lost in 2000. Then he won it in 2001. Came back for one more game and then they go, I'm done.
Yeah, I know. And then Joe Sakic handed him a cup, probably one of the best moments in Stanley Cup final history. So I feel that way about Carey Price. That he's almost at that area now where you're like, that's a guy I'd like to see win a Stanley Cup.
And right now on Sportsnet, they're showing the 93 Stanley Cup final.
Yeah, of course.
So they're not doing any intermissions on that. It's like they go from one period to the next, you know.
And yeah.
You hear players like Dejanay, like Dion Dazne or Dafoos or
Denny Savard. Denny Savard was on that team. Like it was an interesting Vincent Dafoos.
Vincent Dafoos.
Like that was Kirk Muller. And then of course Patrick Roy. They won 10 games in overtime. That Canadiens team. It was crazy. Every time they would go to the front, like, and they were down 2-0 in the first round to the Quebec Nordiques. Came back 1-4 straight. Like that team was. I lost a lot of money because I bet on the Los Angeles Kings to win that because you kind of figured
So
they would win that one.
Yeah, they lost. I looked it up. They lost the first game 4-1.
Yeah, and remember Marty McSorley's illegal stick, buddy.
And
game two.
Yeah, it's like 4-1. They lost, and then the next three games, overtime.
Yeah.
And then game five, Montreal won 4-1. So two games that didn't go overtime, the winning team won 4-1.
Yeah, I know. it was a crazy year. To see them, like after a while, you'd watch them, and they're going to overtime. Like, oh, they're going to win again. That's just all in. And Buffalo, I think they played the Islanders in the third round. And Glenn Healy was the goaltender for the Islanders that year. Like, that was the year the Islanders knocked off the Pittsburgh Penguins in seven games. Ray Ferraro scored in overtime, I think, in game seven. Like, there was all kinds of crazy nonsense going on in that playoff year for Montreal to win the Stanley Cup.
And then a season and a half later, Keane and Waugh got traded to Colorado and then they won the Stanley Cup that year.
Yeah, that was the year. Remember when Patrick Waugh was in net for all nine goals against Detroit? And he made the save, and the fans cheered, and he threw his hands up in the air, came to the bench. I'm never playing for this organization again. There's all kinds of crazy things going on in 96.
And I vaguely remember that. I was like 9 years old when that happened. So I was like,
yeah. So. Yeah. No, I was 22, so I can see why you don't remember that stuff, buddy. I
vaguely remember.
I was in my prime.
So, all right. And the ref, Andy Van Helman.
Yeah.
He came on the podcast of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It had a great conversation with him.
Yeah, that would have been awesome. I would love to talk to more refs, former refs.
Yeah.
The stories those guys have would be legendary.
Yes. Okay, Jamie, thank you.
All right. Thanks, my friend. I appreciate it. I always appreciate coming on.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Front Row Podcast. Download the show on iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to podcasts. Contact us on Twitter or Instagram at Podcast Front Row and join in the conversation. Catch us next time on the Front Row Podcast.